Okay, here we are in Cleveland, Ohio, with Mary Rose Ocar, the Honorable Mary Rose Ocar. This is Rania Seely doing the Cleveland State University Digital History Project, and we're very happy to have Mary Rose on board with us today. So thank you for being here, Mary Rose.
Happy to be with you, and I'm glad you're doing the project.
Thank you. The first question I wanted to ask you, Mary Rose, is, what is your full name, and who named you, and why?
My full name, you don't want my full name. My name is Mary Rose Ocar, two words. My mother, I think, had a lot to do with my name. I actually was born on Jay Avenue in a house because my mother's mother had died at Lutheran Hospital, and she didn't want to have her last child at Lutheran Hospital. She had died on the operating table, so my mother had a phobia. So the doctor said, we'll come to you. So I was born in the home on Jay Avenue before they moved to West 30th. When she had my brother Jimmy, I don't know if you want to know this, but when she had my brother Jimmy, I'm the youngest of five kids. When she had my brother Jimmy, he was born on October 7th, and she thought she had a baby girl, and it's the Feast of the Holy Rosary Day, and she named my brother Jim Mary Rose, and then woke up and found out he was a boy and said, well, everybody needs a sonny Jim. So my sister, who already had three brothers now, really wanted a baby sister. So my mother and dad had another child. That was me. And that's how I got my name. And she always said, you know, I was named after the prettiest flower and Blessed Mother and all that. But nonetheless, I think it had something to do with my brother Jim's birthday, which was the Feast of the Holy the Rosary. That is how I got my name.
Where did you grow up, Mary Rose?
I grew up in the Near West Side, which is now called Ohio City, all of my life, and went to school in the neighborhood and so forth. In Cleveland, Ohio, I was born in Cleveland on Jay Avenue, and one of the most diverse, most fabulous neighborhoods anybody could want to grow up in.
Now, why did your mother and father, why did they choose this area?
I think they chose this area because it was affordable. They were first renting because, you know, they were married in 1931. I'm the youngest of five. Mm-hmm. And they first lived in Amherst, Ohio. Even though my father was fairly educated, like a lot of people from the old country or different countries, they don't really get the kind of jobs that they're really qualified for. So my dad probably wanted to teach and so forth, but didn't get to do that. So they came to Cleveland. He had a sister here and a brother-in-law. And my mother and he met each other in Cleveland, although my mother was born in Pennsylvania. But when her real father died, Salem Ellison was her maiden name, Ellison. When she was five and her two little brothers were my Uncle Lou and Uncle Tom, it was very, very poor times. So my grandmother remarried a widower with the son, my Uncle Tony, and then they had two kids. So she had five brothers, you know, and ultimately because they didn't have much work in Connellsville or Uniontown, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh, they moved to Cleveland and lived in Tremont for a while on Howard Avenue.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt. Your mother, her family came from where?
Her real father came from a village called Kami in Syria. And her mother came from what I found out to be, when I went there, a very sophisticated family in Humps. They had been ambassadors and spoke Swahili and all kinds. Oh, wow. I mean, it was really amazing. You know, you always think, oh, we're probably a little bit better educated. Now, when I went over there, all my cousins on both sides were very, very sophisticated and had some real talent in education.
Wow. And so what brought your mother's family here to Cleveland?
I don't know why they came. They didn't go to Cleveland. They went
to Pennsylvania.
but I'm not sure I know that. I wish I did know that. Probably because they saw that the steel industry was there and so forth. But actually, my grandfather, her real father, and my mother's uncle, her mother's brother, were in business together, and they were very successful. They owned car agencies and department stores and all kinds of stuff. And then he died of the flu epidemic that took a good number of people during World War I. And so my real grandfather died. And my grandmother was a widow with three children, my mother being the oldest of the kids. And then she married a widower who they met in Pennsylvania. And then they moved to Cleveland because there were a lot of people from Connellsville and Uniontown live in greater Cleveland, I found out when I ran for office, because they thought there were more jobs here, manufacture of cars and so on and so forth. My step-grandfather was not a businessman. He was a laborer, and so the times were really tough in those days for these people. My parents met each other in Cleveland. She was born Orthodox, and he was a Maronite. And it was very interesting. They fell in love. She worked for Higbee's and was going to go to New York to be a seller of some kind of sweaters or something. And they fell in love and wanted to get married. And her stepfather, who was very strict, did not want her to marry one of those horrible Maronites. So they had to, my grandmother and her mother gave permission for my mother to marry my dad. They liked him very much. And she was really more or less raised Catholic because in Connellsville, Pennsylvania, where she grew up before the ninth grade, they didn't have an Orthodox church. So they went to the Catholic church. You know, it's somewhat similar. And and she went to Catholic school for the first 3 years and then to a very fine public school. She always talked about her teachers in the public school in Connellsville and how terrific they were. So they ran away and got married and took half their relatives. And can you imagine this? In 1931, he picked her up from Higbee's and they took off to Detroit. And my cousin Esther, my dad's niece, who now is 102 years old and still alive and a fabulous woman, went with them, among others. And they got married at a Maronite church in Detroit, Michigan. And in my mother, when she died, we didn't know she had this, but there was only one sacred thing she had in her life that was private, and that was her cedar chest. And when she died, my brothers said, you and Helen, my sister Helen, go and look in Mom's cedar chest. And we found her a diary there, our first communion pictures, our report cards, all kinds of pictures of me campaigning and stuff like that. Unbelievable stuff that we never knew was in there. And in her diary, which we've finally scanned, one of my nephews scanned it, you know, and because it was fragile. And it says, my dad's best man says, Joe, Margie's stepfather is coming from Cleveland. Take this, and he hands him a little pistol, and my father puts that in his pocket, never used it, and my mom said he walked down the aisle with a gun in his pocket.
Oh my gosh.
So You know, you think today...
True love right there.
Yeah.
True love.
Well, we see people today where religion is important, but it's not anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, now, we see Muslims marrying Catholics and Jews marrying Catholics and so on.
Yeah.
But it is not totally common, but it's still... it happens, and but my parents, just because of the fact that she was Orthodox or born that way, she had to run away.
Wow!
Isn't that amazing
and
that they were that daring?
They were able to come together as.
Oh yeah, they worked it out afterward.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
it
they always worked it out, and it was not it was. They were adventurous. I mean, you have to admit it. That was pretty good.
Do you think that had to do with the times, too? People were really, people were, maybe they felt like, we don't know if we'll live to see tomorrow, so might as well do what we have to do, in hard times.
Well, I think that one of the things that strikes me about the music and my parents and others was that they were very optimistic. And if you, my mother loved music and so forth. My dad had all his little Arabic records and stuff, but she loved. She was sort of a, flapper. As they call those kids, in those days. She taught my sister and I knew all these songs from the 20s and 30s and 40s because of my mom. You would sing them. Like one song that goes, "Keep your sunny side up, up," it's always optimistic, and I think that the one thing that I can honestly say about my parents was that no matter what the times were like, and they were tough times, with all those kids and the post-depression era and World War II and so forth, they were always optimistic, and they instilled that optimism in us. I think. Five of us and a sense of self-confidence. That was one thing that I will value that my parents gave me. My sister used to say, "Mom overdoes it." Helen was very good in art. And my mother would say, "You're better than Michelangelo, Helen." And Helen would say, "Now she goes a little overboard, don't you think?" I say, "Well, I don't know. But I like the fact that she tells us we can do anything."
Yeah.
But anyway... that's just a little bit about my parents, but they were definitely love their Arab American culture.
Yeah.
They didn't call it Arab in those days, but they called it Syrian or whatever.
Your father is from Syria?
Yeah, he was born in Syria in a beautiful little village called Kafrun. It's one of the most beautiful villages
in Lebanon?
No, that's Lebanon. No, you're thinking of Lebanon. Bethany's Lebanon. But we have relatives. The irony is that it just kills me when people are saying, "Oh, I'm Lebanese, I'm not Syrian," and all that crazy stuff. Because I have people who are first cousins in Lebanon with their same last name as mine, only spelled a little different, go to Syria when there's problems, and the people in Syria go to Lebanon when they're, and all you do is go over a mountain.
Yeah.
And they're all related. And it's so, it was all Syria, and it was all, the culture was there. Nobody, it's the French and the English that chopped up all those countries. I mean, we just had Kuwait. Kuwait was made a country in 1961, the way they colonized those countries and certainly took advantage of separating the people, which I think is wrong. And so that's why it doesn't bother me. If they want to call me Lebanese, I don't care, because to me they're the same people as my own people.
Yeah.
And I don't, correct them. I mean, that's really my background, and all of it. I've met many relatives in Lebanon and Syria. In fact, in Lebanon, there's two villages in Lebanon, in the north, beautiful area in the north, called Beit Aukar, which is the way you would pronounce it in Arabic, and, House of Okar. And then near Beirut, there's another Beit Aukar, and that's where the American embassy is.
Oh.
And it's right near a Jesuit and Maronite seminary. And, you know, my father's brother was a Maronite priest, his uncle was a bishop and all that. So, and my mother was Orthodox, but her great-great-uncle was the patriarch Arida of the Maronite church. I saw his picture in Juni, you know. It's wow. Fascinating. They used to call him the traitor because he converted to be a Maronite from being Orthodox. And he became the patriarch of the Maronite church. So anyway.
So interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating to know your stuff about your family.
Mary Rose, can you tell us about your childhood growing up here in this particular neighborhood? What was your childhood like? What did your father do for a living? What did your mom do? And what did you sort of do with your brothers and sisters growing up?
Well, I was lucky. I always feel I was spoiled because I was the youngest, and I liked being spoiled. And I learned a lot from my brothers and sisters, so grade school was kind of easy for me, you know. Because I knew, you know, numbers and different things that, and my mother read to us every night. So we really, she was pretty good in English, even though she had a ninth grade education. But in Pennsylvania, they used to, by heart, know Shakespeare. I mean, it was unbelievable. Stuff I learned in graduate school, she learned in grade school. So it was terrific growing up. I had a very happy childhood. I honestly feel, and I'm not trying to be idealistic about it, I did. I was the youngest of five. I had, my sister was 7 years older than me, and three brothers older than me. And this was a very diverse neighborhood. We had people who were Syrian who lived down the street, people who were Irish who certainly were around here. Italian, oh, everybody,
and
sure.
Did everyone try to get to know each other's
culture? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Well, just to give an example, my mother learned how to make Syrian bread and kibbeh and stuff from her grandmother. And she didn't know how to cook too well when she first got married, but her grandmother was still living, and her mother was deceased, unfortunately. But she pitched in and showed her how to make all this stuff. Delicious. And yet we still had meatloaf and scalloped potatoes and hot dogs and like everybody, all the American families. But these Irish kids would come to pick up my brothers to play baseball, you know, the Chambers and the Colder kids. And they'd say, my mother would be making hamburgers on Syrian bread, she called it. And they'd come in and they'd smell this bread and was out of this world. And they'd say, Mrs. Okar, tell Larry and Jimmy, two of my brothers, that you need us to help you bake and let them play baseball. You know, they wanted to have the food. And my mother would say, nah, Jackie, nah, Ghost Chambers, we called him. You guys go play baseball, and you're all coming over here to eat afterward. So, yes, did we have friends of all backgrounds? Yep. And we had a lot of Slovak kids who went to St. Wendelin's. We had a lot of kids who were Protestant who went to different Trinity Lutheran Church or United Church of Christ on right next to St. Patrick's on Bridge. I went to St. Patrick's grade school and Lord Academy, which used to be on 41st and Bridge, where I taught as a lay teacher all the subjects I wanted to teach, drama and English and speech, and directed all their plays.
Yeah, did you always want to be an English teacher? Did you know from
no.
a young age, or did you just develop that through time?
No, I probably wanted more to be an actress or something crazy.
I can see you doing that, actually. You're very good.
Well, probably, you know, but I was a speech and drama major at Ursuline, where I went to college, undergraduate school. They let me take extra courses, so I had a double major, never any charge. I mean, and I actually did not want to go there. I wanted to go to Marquette, but my brother Jimmy was going to law school at Georgetown. Larry just came back from the Navy, and he was going to Cleveland State, which was Fenn, I think, at that time. And Helen was taking some classes in art. And, you know, my father just wasn't able to send me off to Marquette. So I was going to work a year, and then the nun at Ursuline called me and said, you would come down here and visit the school. What are you going to do? And it was August. I said, Sister, I'm going to wait a year and work and save money for a tuition to go to Marquette. She said, Mary Rose, I have news for you. You probably won't do that if you work a year. And she said, why don't you come to Ursuline? And she said, you know, it's not very expensive, and it wasn't. And so I did, and I had wonderful experience there. Not because of, you know, anything, but I was president of my class 3 years in a row, and then I was student government president. And if you were student government president in the 60s, they gave you a stipend to travel to other colleges because of the 60s and all the movements going on. And they called it SGA, the Student Government Association. And I traveled to different campuses. I would never have had that experience if I went to Ohio State or Marquette or something. But because of that small institution, and I think because it was a women's college, what they really believed in was to develop a female intellectually, socially, morally, and physically, and to your fullest capacity that was drilled into us. And I think that, ironically, Mary McCarthy wrote a book about women in Congress. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Congress, most of us went to women's colleges.
Wow.
Barbara Mikulski, Jerry Ferraro, Barbara Kennelly, et cetera, we all went to women's colleges. And it was kind of interesting that she figured that out. So
I want to ask you, were your parents, did they instill in you this sort of activism or something? Were all of your siblings like that? They kind of went into fields that were more about, you know, social activism, or at least something, you know, being aware of politics. Were you raised with that, or do you think you just sort of fell into it?
I read my mother's diary, and she said, Joe and I voted a straight Democratic ticket. Well, to put that in a diary, you know, they were Roosevelt people, I think.
Okay.
Although my father did vote for Dwight Eisenhower. He really liked Eisenhower.
Yeah.
But my mother was a precinct committee person only because she was a homemaker. My dad did not want her to work, and she was raising five kids. And I'm glad she was home, to be honest, although she could have gone on. And probably could have finished school and so on. She's pretty bright. But self-taught, a lot of our people are self-taught, you know, and they both read a lot. And I do think the reason they asked my mother to be a precinct person was that she was the one that if there was no light on West 30th, she would be the one to ask for a light on West 30th. Or if the garbage, people would call her and say, Mrs. O'Connor, why don't you call City Hall and say, yeah, we need to have our garbage picked up. So she was pretty active, even though she was home a lot.
What got her that position, though? Did she want
the councilwoman, who I later, ran for council myself and against her, although she gave up her seat, and I ran against somebody else. She asked my mother to do that because she knew my mother would be active and be helpful. She just had it in her. She liked people, and I think people liked her. I remember one time in the 60s, I was teaching a new teacher, and I was supposed to teach at West Tech. I had a contract, and I was offered a job at Lourdes when I went there to speak about Ursuline. Mm-hmm. But they let me teach the classes I wanted. West Tech wanted me to teach freshman English. I wanted to direct plays and teach senior English literature and stuff. And so the principal offered me this spectacular curriculum to do. And that's just what I wanted to do, to use my double major. And so my father, before he passed away, gave me the advice to teach as a lay teacher at the school I went to, which I loved. It was a wonderful Catholic school. They should never have closed it. It was the best school going and very diverse. But I do think there was a sense of activism in our family. I mean, a lot of the immigrants, whenever they came here, they would come to my father, who could write in Arabic and read in Arabic, and my mother, who was very good in writing, for whatever, if they needed something and they needed somebody in English to do it. My mother knew Arabic fluently. She learned it from her mother, and as a little kid, she knew Arabic. And so they were always people that people came to who were new or had a problem or whatever and needed somebody who could translate or whatever. And
were there a lot of Syrians in this area that needed help?
I think there were a lot of people, period, who needed help. But a lot of them, they'd come from the old country. You know, they didn't have a job. They didn't know how to apply. They didn't have a biography, a resume. They didn't, you know. And my dad would help them, and my mother would too. And I'm not saying they did that full time, because they had their own family to take care of. But I do think that because of their his ability in reading and writing in Arabic, and hers in reading and writing, understanding Arabic and reading and writing in English, a lot of people came to them. They were a little more contemporary in a way, you know, than some of the people just coming over, even though if they were younger. But I do remember that. And then we lived across the street from the Jesuits. They used to come over our house just to get away from each other, you know, because they lived in the tower. You know, my father would host the priests, and he thought it was really beautiful that they wanted to come. And one of the Jesuits used to, who knew Arabic, got a hold of some of my father's books, and they were in Arabic. They were Aristotle and Plato translated in Arabic. Said, is my dad really reading that? I'm just taking these philosophy courses, you know. I didn't, you know, we never knew as much. You don't appreciate, I think, some of the things about your parents until you learn about it later. Mm-hmm. But no, they were very good, and they were very active in both St. Patrick's, St. Marin's, a little bit in St. George's, because my mom knew the former, what was his name, that just died, that became the head of the whole church. Mm-hmm. His first mission was on West 14th Street. Mm-hmm. You know, they were looked upon as sort of a sense a little bit leadership. And my father knew the liturgy of the Maronite Church because his brother was a priest and he had been an altar boy. So in the old days, there'd be a man there. They didn't have altar boys. They'd have a man there responding to the priest at the Maronite Church, St. Marin's.
So both your father and your mother, they were active in their churches.
Yeah, they were. My mother was Orthodox active in the... Well, not the Orthodox. No, my mother became Catholic.
Okay.
She always felt she had been raised Catholic. She was more Catholic than anything else. But we were very ecumenical when I was growing up. We did not... my father, he used to say that the thing that's very important about the three great religions... you know, the Muslim religion, the Christian religion, and the Jewish religion, is that they had a belief in one God.
Yeah.
Very fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
And that should have made them closer together. And I think that was disappointing that it didn't always.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, I went on a little bit too much, but go ahead.
No, you did just fine, Mary Rose. No, this is, I want to ask you too, what would you say was the best part of being the product of immigrants? And what would you say was the hardest part about being a product of immigrants?
Well, my mother wasn't an immigrant, first of all.
Right, but...
But my father, you're talking about my dad.
Okay.
Although she was a first generation.
Did you ever feel kind of, like, what was your experience sort of going to school, sort of everyday life? Did you ever feel different, or did you always feel accepted? Was there ever a time...
Well, we were very diverse in this neighborhood to begin with. But I do think that when I was growing up, Tony, wouldn't you say when we were growing up, it was predominantly Irish, wouldn't you say, in Hungarian?
Absolutely.
A lot of Hungarians around here. She grew up around here, too, and went to St. Pat's in Lourdes. I love St. Patrick's Day, and my father would say, now, don't you worry. When those Irish kids say you're not Irish, of course, I know all the songs better than they do, he'd say, Patrick means patriarch. Patriarch, he was from the old country. That's what my dad would say, he was from the Middle East. So he said, you tell them, he's not Italian, not this and not that. Patriarch, that's what he means, Patrick.
Wow.
Well, he might have been, you know, you never know. Because when you look at Gaelic, which is not like English at all, there is some similarity to the Arabic writing.
You know, even during the time when they were translating, the Irish monks were translating works of Aristotle, like some of them had to learn Arabic to do that.
That's right.
Some of them, there were some like that.
And if you look at, there's a guy in some town in West Virginia, two of the guys that worked in our office when I was head of ADC, Kareem Shore and his brother Noir, who are Syrian Muslims, Muslim. Their father's a doctor. And one of the best schools for training doctors is the University of Damascus. In fact, Cleveland Clinic, they wanted to hire me to recruit doctors from Syria and Lebanon and Palestine, etc. 56 doctors at Cleveland Clinic are Arabic, and probably most of them immigrants, and heads of departments and everything at the clinic. And same is true at University Hospital. Some of their best doctors happen to be from the Middle East. This guy from Kareem's father and his partner had this museum in one of the larger towns in West Virginia where these kids grew up. And he has the original book written in Arabic. He has all these ancient things plus contemporary things about healthcare and what they used, and he had I have to call you back, thanks. So
he had this book that was
all in Arabic, and it was doctor was Hippocrates. It was Arabic, and then they translated it to Greek. That's what he said. So I don't know, but he had all these ancient Arabic books all about medicine, And I really do think the origin of culture is from that region of the world. You know, the alphabet, the numbers, I mean, you know, there's nothing we should be ashamed of in terms of our culture, that's for sure.
Mary Rose, So I take it then you always felt like, because you're in this area, it was very diverse. Did you ever come across anything different than that, where you felt
No, I really didn't. No, I didn't. When I ran for city council, this neighborhood has people very loyal to each other. I don't know of any other place like it. And when I ran, a lot of the people I grew up with lived in West Park and here and there. But they're very loyal, and they helped me a lot. My classmates from grade schools too. My best friends, most of them are Irish kids.
We're always kids at heart.
Yeah, well, that's how I think of them. But I never felt inferior to anybody because that was not instilled in me. On the other hand, I knew that, you know, I was a little unique in my class because, but we did have diversity. We had Hungarian kids. We had who came during the Hungarian Revolution,
yes,
and went to St. Patrick's, and we had people who were Italian living in our neighborhood. We had lots of Irish kids living in our neighborhood. Some were poor, some were not so poor. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people from the Middle East who lived in our neighborhood. And other Appalachians and Hispanics later came in, and African Americans. So I felt somewhat unique because of my ethnic background. But I don't think I felt in any way inferior. In fact, I knew that in many ways my friends loved coming over to my house. I don't think I should print this, would want this printed, but when my friends visited me in Washington when I was in Congress, 9 of my girlfriends from grade school and high school came to Washington. We had so much fun. They're still my good friends. And we were talking about our backgrounds. Every one of them had alcoholic parents. And I didn't have that. The only time my father drank was at Christmas, and they would bootleg, because they didn't sell it in stores, and they'd have Cabernet or something, you know, with this. And that was the only time my mother never drank, so that was the only time my parents drank. Oh, dear. Okay. Tony, keep that email from Mark George, okay?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Mary Rose, can I ask you, what kinds of struggles do you believe Arabs and Arab Americans face today from your own experience working with them, working with organizations that protect their civil rights? Have you noticed anything recently, or do you think
things
are getting better? I mean, I'm just...
No, I don't think they're better. I mean, they're different.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of things do they face?
Well, I think they face terrible things. And when you hear political candidates talking so outrageously about immigration and about Muslims and about whoever,
mm-hmm.
And a presidential candidate talks that way, please... And it's not partisan with me. If Hillary Clinton talked that way, I'd feel the same way about her. And in fact, my favorite candidate in some ways was Bernie Sanders, because I thought he was the most fair-minded about the Middle East. But anyway.
What would you say are their struggles?
Their struggles are after 9/11.
Yeah.
It was bad enough for some of them, because there was a new wave. You know, there was a wave of immigration in around the turn of the century, you know, and it was mostly Christians who were trying to escape the Ottoman Empire. Even Muslims from the Middle East faced the same prejudice in some ways. You know, so we're not just talking about Christians, because they were pretty bad to the Palestinian, Syrian, whoever, Iraqi, you know, people who live by the Mesopotamian River, they were pretty prejudiced toward Muslims, too, and made them join the army and all that. Today, after 9/11 especially, at the airports, at just about everywhere, they have a double standard in evaluation. Now, it is true that the so-called terrorist, although we've had terrorists in this country too, in Montana floating around against the government and all that, white supremacists and all that, and Ku Klux Klan in the past, and the way they treated blacks and so forth in different areas. So we've had to deal with all that. But the fact is that to categorize a whole group of people because of a few idiots that are terrorists is disgraceful.
Yeah.
You cannot take away a person's civil rights and due process. And when you take away, which is constitutional, it's against our Constitution. Mm-hmm. And I felt very, very strongly, even before 9/11, as I mentioned to you over the phone, when I asked my former head of immigration who did my casework on that, mm-hmm. who was an expert, Trish Cooney, what were the two groups, who had the hardest time getting a visa or coming to this country? Middle Eastern people and Irish, because they thought the Irish were terrorists trying to, you know, bring in weapons or something, you know.
Yeah.
It was real hard for them to come in, mostly Christians. And Middle Eastern people had a harder time even then to come, even though the laws had changed. And it depended on who was head of immigration. We have an immigration office. I swear I think the guy head of it is somewhat prejudiced. I did not think that Mr. Brown, who used to be, was fabulous because he was very balanced and fair-minded. Did he want people to come who could be suspicious and all that? Of course not. On the other hand, he had a sense of compassion, and he was equal about everybody. And we don't see that all the time. And after 9/11, it was even worse. You know, you know that the new mosque, somewhat new mosque in Parma, mm-hmm. kid was drunk and crashed into it. We had, when I was head of ADC, we helped the Sikhs who wear turbans, and they thought they were Arab or something, and they were getting shot up in New York City, and we helped them form their own organization so they could fight for their rights. And we made the Justice Department, when they had meetings with us about civil rights, invite different groups that force prejudice too.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil Rights Division of Justice we worked very closely with. When I was
head, you think too with the refugees, the whole ISIS thing happening too nowadays. Like,
well, nowadays I just heard that he's finally letting 10,000 refugees
mm-hmm.
come in from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
The president, and I must say I'm a Democrat, but I'm very disappointed in some of the foreign policies of President Obama. I can say I like some of the things he did, but I expected more of him because of his own background.
Mm-hmm.
It's a product of an African Muslim.
Yeah.
Whether he is or not doesn't interest me.
To deny people the legal entry into the country.
That's right, and to
yeah.
and you know, you can certainly vet the people. I can understand where they have to be vetted properly, but if we do this, but it's not just these people. I remember going to Puerto Rico with my friend Congressman, who wanted me to come and see the way they were treating the Haitians. They had them locked up in cages like they were animals.
Oh.
They didn't want the Haitians to come in, but they let the Cubans come in, you know, who swam across the Gulf or something to get in, you know, or Miami, because the Cubans were, you know, very pro-whatever. And but Haitians, they were black, nah.
Wow.
They wanted to get away from the same restrictions some of the Cubans had. But they weren't allowed. So, I mean, I do think that this has happened, and I do think 9/11 with at the airports, and I can understand at the airports why they're there's more scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we had countless cases of people being held for hours and so forth and days because they wouldn't let them in this country. But I had experiences. I remember once one of my friends, I won't mention his name, who was a very popular state rep, had a family reunion. He's Irish. And his cousin was coming in, who was a folk singer from Ireland. And he calls me on a Sunday. He said, they're not letting my cousin in. He's 19 years old. He's got his guitar or whatever he had. And they're holding him up in Canada because he was on an Air Canada flight that went to Toronto first or somewhere first and then Cleveland. And he said, they're holding him up because they said he might be related to the Irish, you know, terrorists. And so I had to call, you know, and get that. And we got him in, but he was delayed a day. We had cases in ADC where parents were going to a wedding. They were Egyptian. The mother was an American citizen. The father had just gotten, he was a naturalized citizen. The kid's name was Mohammed Mohammed. He was 5. So they said to the parents, you can go, but he has to stay. You know, we said, what? Well, they were members of ADC, and they called our office, fortunately. And they had to stay overnight. They missed the wedding. But they did get first-class seats. They apologized to him for keeping the little kid because his name was Muhammad Muhammad. So we faced that. I had Catholic nuns that they kept in prison without due process. So please, who are Lebanese, you know, it's not just Muslims, but Muslims have it a little bit harder. It was Christian, anybody a little darker. I mean, Syrian Jews used to come to our office for help because they were prejudiced against at the airport. And in fact, there was an ambassador who was the ambassador of Bahrain, and she was an Arab Jew. Mm-hmm. Her family had lived in Bahrain for generations. They were Jewish. Mm-hmm. She practiced her religion, and they made her an ambassador. And she came to me. Ambassadors, you know, they have immunity from just about everything. And they don't, you got the ambassador passport, they don't hold you up. Well, they would hold her up all the time. So she came to ADC. I got to be a friend of hers. And she, one of my guys handled it for her so that never happened again. But here she was the ambassador, you know, because she was an Arab Jew, you know, held up. So she couldn't believe it. I couldn't either. But anyway, that yes, I think there's terrible things, and I think refugees today, what I think should have happened is that there should have been an attempt by our country and others, the Russians, to have reconciliation in Syria. Because there's no question that Christians like Assad because he was fair to Christians. Fairer than the other Arab countries. Mm-hmm. In fact, most of the countries don't even have a Christian church. On the other hand, some of the bloodiness of both sides and others in our own country, mm-hmm. giving weapons to people, you know, what is this? Try to make them sit down and talk to each other. It was an incident that spurred the whole thing with graffiti or something. It's stupid. I have found, both in the Middle East, in Palestine and Israel and so on, I see all these people meeting privately, you know, but the leaders are the ones at fault. Mm-hmm. And my judgment, I mean, you cannot take that away from some of them.
Some of the best things happening are things happening behind closed doors.
Exactly.
What's being shown in the...
Yeah, but our country has a Congress that... when I would go on trips to the Middle East as a member of Congress, you know, I'll tell you a quick, cute story about that. First time I ever went to Jerusalem, which I'm staying at the King David Hotel. We'd just gotten there. We had traveled through war-torn Lebanon, through the south of Lebanon into Israel. And we were exhausted, and they put us up at the King David Hotel, and they had these big window shades. And I look out the window, and there's Jerusalem, mm-hmm. all lit up. It was like all the Bible classes I ever took, you know, pictures of it. And I said, holy Toledo, it really does look like that. So the next day, Teddy Kollek was the mayor of Jerusalem at the time, the first time I was there. And he... said, you know, you're on a busy schedule. I know you don't have time to do everything we want to show you in Jerusalem, But so we're going to go to the Wailing Wall. And I said, okay. And I was the only woman, of course, because there were only 16 or 17 women at the time, and out of 435 House members at the time. So I was very often the only woman in a delegation. And he said, and then we're going to take you to, you know, some mountain somewhere. I said, well, I have to go. I want to see the mosque, and I want to see St. Helen's Church. And because I can't not go where Christ is buried, right, apparently. Right. And Teddy says, I said, I'll meet you at the Wailing Wall. You know, how long are you going to be there? So I said, I think I know where it is. And so he says, oh, no, you can't do that because we don't have the time. I said, I have to do it, you know. I just can't
right.
not
when else
do
could
that.
You have that opportunity?
So here, all the other guys, you know, these other cowardly Congress members, I'm teasing, said, well, we want to go see where Christ was buried in the mosque, too. And then Teddy Kollek says, of course you do. We'll go to all three. So that was that, you know. So,
oh, good thing you
yeah.
were with them.
Yeah.
Rose.
Well, they always never met with the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
I'd go off and meet with, like, the academics who are Jewish and Palestinian, talking together about how can we reconcile this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Not always perfectly, but they were at least talking to each other. And these guys would go flying in F-16s that we paid for. I mean, it just extraordinary. They're not as bad as they used to be, but I felt it was extraordinarily prejudiced.
And so when you went then to see the church and everything, did it move you? Did you feel?
Oh, my God, it was magnificent.
Yeah, yeah.
I really.
I'm sure your colleagues thanked you.
Sure did.
For mentioning it.
Well,
right?
Another time I went to Palestine, you know, they went and met with all these generals and all that. I said, I'm going to Ramallah. I would like to meet with the people. So I've been invited to meet with the people. So, I'd split with them. I'd say that with those guys. You know, I'd meet with all Begin, Prime Minister Begin, and all these different people, and go to the meetings like everybody else, and it was interesting, and I should do that. But I wanted to meet some of the Palestinian people, too, besides the Israelis. I don't call them Jewish. They were Israelis. And so I go to Ramallah, and they make the best adah in Ramallah of any place, they say. So they had these tiny bottles of adah, and they gave me a case of it. And we were on our own plane, one of these big tabalard planes, cargo planes, so we could bring extra stuff on the plane. So I met them, you know, and they met me, and so on, and I have all this adah. And these guys said, Miriam, where'd you go? I said, well, I went to Ramallah. You guys went and met with flying your F-16s. You could do that in the United States since we gave it to them. And I said, and, you know, I just felt I had gone to all the meetings, the formal meetings, and I wanted to meet with real people. And they said, well, what's in that case? I said, little bottles of adah, you know. And they said, can we get some? I said, no. You didn't want to go? You know, I gave them some. But I said, you didn't want to go to Ramallah, and they wanted me to have this. And I said, okay, I'll give you each a little small. It was like a small little cylinder bottle, all these little bottles. And so they all got you know, because they didn't know what the hell it was. And they went, these guys.
Yeah,
so,
that's strong, though.
Yeah, well, it's very strong if you're not eating it with kimchi or something. Of grape leaves, you know. But anyway, but I do think that, you know, in Lebanon was occupied. A third of it was occupied for 20 or more years. I mean, who else goes through this stuff? You know, and that doesn't mean, I think myself, that if the Palestinian people, they had, what is his name? He used to speak at our convention. Isn't that terrible? He was a professor at Columbia University, Palestinian.
You Khaled Rashidi?
No.
Would it be James
Zuckby? No. No, not James
Edward Said.
Said.
Okay, yeah.
Edward went there, they kicked him out, but he preached nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And I think that retaliation for the way you're treated is so tempted, mm-hmm. particularly with the wall and this and that, mm-hmm. you know, and taking your homes away and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi said, and that's how Edward Said wanted to do it. And he was getting a real following in Palestine for nonviolence and protesting the way they were treated. And I must say this, that most people don't know this, but when I was ADC, I would get reports from the Israeli Civil Rights Organization there, is fabulous. And they would be the most critical about what was going on.
Really?
Fantastic people. Wow. And so maybe the professor would know who I'm talking about, and I have some of their reports and all that in some box somewhere, but they were fantastic. I couldn't believe it, and I wanted to meet with them. And also the friends, you know, the people who are, what do they call the friends?
Quakers.
The Quakers. Yeah, they would get me into prisons to meet with people.
Wow.
I couldn't get in. I wanted to meet with people who were unlawfully imprisoned in Palestine, and the Quakers would get me in.
Wow.
But I do think that we're a failure as a country in our leadership. And there are so many people who are thoughtful, Jewish Americans and Arab Americans, who want to get together and try to get together about Palestine. But on the question of Syria, now some of my Jewish friends are saying, oh, my God, we're always against Syria and all that. And it was the only country that had religious freedom in many ways. And Lebanon had it too, but they didn't have any synagogues. You know, when Mike Wallace went to Syria, and the Jewish Americans were saying they're so prejudiced towards Syrians,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jewish Syrians,
mm-hmm.
He went there and found that was just the opposite.
Wow.
And he reported that way. Mike Wallace spoke at our convention twice, and they were ready to lynch him, and he was Jewish because he came back and said, what I was told wasn't true. They're treated very well, and they have their synagogues, and they have homes, and they pray, and you know, like everybody else does there. I don't say it's perfect, but I think it was more perfect than most places. And I think our country could have preached reconciliation. And I do think that the leadership of all the groups didn't try. And then you had the intrusion of the Saudis and so on and so on and so forth. Could have been helpful, but wasn't.
Well, I would like to thank you, Mary Rose, for your time. Your stories are so interesting, your family life, your growing up here, and all of the wonderful things that you've done for this community, for all people in this community. Thank you for your time, and thank you for this interview.
Well, I want to say one quick thing about running for Congress, if I can.
Oh, absolutely, if you could.
No,
yes.
Because we...
Go ahead.
I just want to say that when anybody ever wins for an election, you don't win on your own. You can win with a lot of money sometimes and lie about people or something. But I won because I had a lot of volunteers. And I had people I grew up with. I had students, former students. I had neighbors. I had friends. I had cousins. That's how I won. We didn't have a lot of money. You know, in this case, I ran against some people with lots of money.
What brought you into running for Congress? What made you do that? Did you do it on your own, or did you feel people were encouraging you?
Well, I was a councilwoman, and 16% of public housing is on 25th Street going towards St. Lakeview and Riverview down.
Uh-huh.
And that's a federal program.
Oh.
And women, there were no locks on the doors. There was drug addiction in some of the family units. And on two tracts of land, they put, it's really against the Fair Housing Act, two tracts of land, all sandwiched in all these people. And I wanted to help them. So I'd go to the city, well, no, that's a federal program. We can't put locks on the door. I'd say, well, can we get police protection? No, we can't, because they have, CMHA has their own police force. And so we had, it was a federal program. So I went to Washington with some of my constituents. I was a councilwoman, trying to get some help for these people. Yeah. There were seniors, there were families, there were kids. I brought a senior, I brought a nurse who had a little health clinic in one of the high rises, and she called me once and said, what are you doing about this? The lady was killed, was hurt, beaten up for 7 cents, and she's a senior, and she's in the hospital with broken ribs and everything. And so I said, well, come with me to Washington. I'm trying to find out what to do. I'm trying to get some them to do something about it. So we went to Washington, and it was like talking to a telephone pole. And they said, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. And three of the people that ran CMHA in the city went to jail, you know. They opened, I mean, it was unbelievable, the corruption. So I decided that I was a councilwoman, couldn't do anything about it. I decided I was going to run for Congress. Jim Stanton, who was the Congress member, was giving up his seat to run against Howard Metzenbaum. And I thought, I'm going to bring this issue up, you know, and I can do it because it's a federal office. And so I decided to do it with a lot of encouragement. And George Forbes even was the council president, who was very, very helpful to me in his own way. And I'm going to tell that story in my biography, but I don't want to tell it now. Anyway, so once I start running, I realized Social Security was an issue, peace in the Middle East was an issue. And, you know, I was targeted. I mean, they raised tons of money against me because of my ethnic background. And, you know, but I...
Was that like the first time you felt like, okay...
Yeah.
This is when I'm being attacked? Like, that was the
yeah,
first
that was
the
first time I really experienced prejudice.
Wow.
And money, I mean, really a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I ran up against people like Tony Celebrezze and people like that, whose father had been a federal judge, and he was mayor of Cleveland, and his father, nice guy, by the way, who was HHS secretary under Kennedy. So he had tons of money, all of them did, except me, because I was a teacher, you know. But I had more volunteers than they did. And we had these little rose pens. I don't know if one's in here. Here it is. Here's one of them. They were red and see, Mary Rose O'Carr for Congress. And I could get in places. My mother named me Mary Rose. I used to go by Mary because people would confuse my name. And we called Mary, Mary Rose, Rosemary. And it was the best thing I ever did to use Mary Rose, because I had
very
a
clever.
Yeah. So, one of my classmates from Ursuline thought of it, and we handed out these rose pens, and I could get in anywhere with them. And in fact, one of them's in the Smithsonian Institution, as a gimmick, that won, and that worked, and the guys would come in with their literature, all my opponents. And they couldn't get in different places, you know. But everybody wanted the rose pen, you know, among other things. But I just wanted to say that about Congress, because we're under the impression that money, 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 money. When I ran, it wasn't money. I don't think we raised more than $40,000, and others raised millions. But I had the volunteers, and I was a councilwoman who got on television a lot because of what we were doing, not, you know, and trying to get rid of arson and stuff like that. So I did get some good publicity, television publicity, but that was free. But they were on all the time on television with ads, and I was on, I think, one weekend or something. I had a few dollars. But anyway.
So the money that's poured into political parties now, it's not like it was when you were running. Are you saying that it's
no.
changed?
No. No, it hasn't changed. I think it's worse.
Okay.
Now, but if you have the money, I mean, I can tell you that if you look at my race, Tony Celebrezze must have been on television 24/7. And I'm not criticizing him for that. He had the money. He had money from all over. And there was money targeting me as an Arab American. And what would I do? And my father said, you know what, I remembered something my father said, and he was not living then. But he said, what's right for the United States will be right for the Middle East. And we have not followed that. Of course, he had more to say than that. But anyway, the volunteers that we had and the ability to really like campaigning and going out and meeting people and having people that would work for you. And my oldest brother, Bernie, was my best volunteer. He was the salesman of the year, always. And he would say, you don't know Garfield Heights, right? And he said, I'm going to go out there. Next day he'd say, I got three different places you have to go in Garfield Heights, dying to meet you. And so he was...
So he was like your right-hand man.
He was one of the right-hand men, yeah. But he was just fabulous. But he did something...
so your family was involved in a lot of...
My brother Jimmy... I used his phones. We had people who would make phone calls, and he was a lawyer, and so he had a few lines, and they were somewhat involved. My sister, they were encouraging. My mother, when my mother was very sick at the time, and unfortunately she had been hit by a drunk driver, and it spiraled a little problem she had, and... when they interviewed my mother after I won, she said, well, everything my kids do, I'm proud of. And I was proud when she was directing plays at Lourdes Academy, she's proud that I won. But unfortunately, she died about a month and a half after I took office. So she never got to see me there. But she did go to Washington with my dad and me to visit my brother when he was at Georgetown. So they had gone to Washington at least once. I think the thing about our people, I just want to say this last thing. Our people, I've always said this, my dad was born on the 4th of July, literally, not a bunch of baloney. And he would, so when I came to this country, I thought everybody was celebrating my birthday, But I do think that our people believe in God, in their church or their mosque. They believe in their families. They want the best for their families. And I believe very strongly that our people have a love for this country and their roots. And you can't explain to others how important those values are. And to make our people look like we're devils or terrorists or something is obnoxious. Mm-hmm. Do we have a few people who prostitute the integrity of their religion or whatever? Yeah, I think those people are creeps. On the other hand, they're taking advantage of some of the injustice and hyperbolizing it in their way. And it's really a shame that they have done that and have followers, because peace is the only... if you ask women all over the world, what are the three most important issues, a woman will say, in polls taken, civil rights, you want economic security, you want to be paid fairly, you want to have clean water if you're African or whatever, and... number one issue is peace. Mm-hmm. We have peace. We have enough money for all this other stuff.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, that's what happens when you have, and you need more women in public life who are thoughtful. So.
And you were one of the first, right? You were one of the first.
I was the first Democratic woman in Ohio, the Frances Payne Bolton, her husband died, and then she ran. She was a great gal, you know. She did a lot for nurses in the military, and but she was way ahead of me. I mean, she was like in the 40s, and then all the way to the 60s. And I called her, and you know, she wanted to meet with me, because I was only the second woman to win, and the first Democratic woman. She was Republican, and I didn't sort of inherit it. I mean, it's not a political name or anybody else's name. And so I was supposed to meet with her, and then she died. Oh. And I went to her funeral at Old Stone Church.
Wow.
Didn't get to meet her.
But she handed the baton to you, though, indirectly.
Maybe. Well, she was very happy to hear from me.
Yeah.
I wanted to meet her because she was the only other woman who had ever served in Margaret Chase Smith. If you read the way those women were treated in Congress, it's unbelievable.
Really?
Was bad enough when I was there. It's like a plantation in the beginning. But I'm just telling you that, you know, they were, you have to read that. If you ever do a real paper, do it on Congresswoman from the beginning, and you'll see in the record, because Congress takes all the words down. And the way they were treated was, and we weren't treated great in the beginning, but that's why I love Tip O'Neill, who, by the way, his favorite daughter-in-law is Lebanese. And so he knew a little bit about our culture.
Wow.
But he was very fair to women, and more than fair. And he'd say, okay, all you guys, and some of the women say, why does he call us guys? I said, I don't care as long as he puts me on the committee I want.
You know? There you go.
So that's enough of me.
Thank you so much, Mary Rose.
Okay,
thank you so much for your time. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good luck. This is a great thing. And